Welcome to another edition of Spotlight Conversations with the Postdoc Way. I'm Brian Jarecki, and I'm pleased to have my next guest, Dr. Joanne Kamins from AdGene. She is the executive director of AdGene, who's also extremely interested in career development and career exploration. She's a participant in multiple outreach activities, including presenting at places such as AAAS, NIH, University of Michigan, Minnesota, Yale, MIT, and Harvard, in addition to multiple other places. Joanne received her bachelor's degree from University of Pennsylvania and then received her PhD from Harvard University in genetics. So welcome, Joanne.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thank you very much for contacting me. I've followed a lot of your blogs and a lot of your webinars that you put on. So I was hoping maybe you can start off by giving us a little bit of background about what you do and maybe a little bit of an introduction. Kind of describing some of your background and your experience in the science world and career development.
Sure. So I went right from grad school and started at an industry job. I worked at a pharmaceutical company. First it was called BASF, and then it became Abbott in the middle. I stayed in the same desk for 15 years, but the company was acquired in the middle of my time there. And I went straight as a scientist. I didn't do much of a postdoc. I stayed in my lab, did a little bit of postdoc time. That was because I had a pre-existing condition. I was expecting my son, and my advisor was nice. I wouldn't have been able to get medical coverage had I, left my job at that point. So that was really good. And I had my son while finishing up in graduate school, and then started at BASF and Abbott as a scientist. It's an immunology part of BASF, of pharmaceutical research and basic research for drug development.
Okay.
And I stayed there for a long time, and I got promoted a few times, did lots of different things along the way. And just short of my 15-year anniversary, I went to a biotech company called RXI Pharmaceuticals, which is an RNAi startup, small company. At the time, doubled in size pretty much over the 4 years that I was there. I started out as the director of research, and that sort of opportunity came about because while I was at Abbott, when the first RNAi papers came out, so RNAi, for people who don't know, is a specific technology that technology and area of science that really wasn't known until 98 when Craig Mello and Andy Fier basically discovered it. And when I read those first papers, I'm sort of a molecular biologist techie. I was pretty excited, and I kind of familiarized myself and became sort of the Abbott expert in that field. And so the opportunity to be director of research at a biotech startup came through some connections that I had made earlier in my career in the RNAi community. So that was a really great opportunity for me. I stayed there for 4 years. I ended up in a more business development-oriented role.
Right.
So along the way, I transitioned to be in the business development department. It's a small company, so there aren't really departments, but having a different sort of somewhat more refocused responsibilities. The company was moving toward a more chemical approach, and I'm not much of a chemist. So I was working on the science side of collaborations with all the partners that we were talking to, trying to do deals and, get support and funding for some of our research projects. So, and that I really enjoyed that a lot. And then that company moved into development, which is very common in biotech. So the research staff was laid off. So the company went from something like 36 people to 6 people overnight, and I was close enough to what was going on that it was not such a surprise. So that's kind of a normal lifetime of a biotech. You kind of get bought or, the research staff will be let go to provide funding for the development of a drug. And there's a drug in the clinic now from that company, so that's exciting for me to watch. It's in phase 2 in humans right now. And so when I after that, I started looking for a new position, and the position came open at AdGene, and AdGene is a nonprofit biotech, which is a little unusual, of course. For people who don't know about AdGene, we're a very large repository for a research reagent called a plasmid, which is a little circle of DNA. It's like a library. We have 30,000 different things in our library. We have a very interactive website with all kinds of resources for scientists. And the mission of the company is to facilitate sharing of research reagents and collaboration between life sciences labs around the world. We ship to 80 countries. So it's free to deposit to AdGene. And so this, to me, was just a great leadership opportunity, a great opportunity to work at a company that was really doing exciting things. So now I'm still at Agene. I've been there just over 2 years. I'm really enjoying it. The company has doubled in size since I started, and we're doing, you know, spreading the word internationally, and it's a very exciting place to work. Along the way, I had another child. So my daughter was born while I was in the early days at the pharmaceutical company, and both my kids are now in college, so sort of entering a new stage this year.
That's great. That's really impressive. I mean, the whole arc of starting off in more of a science background and then moving into business development, I think that's something a lot of people that I've interacted with are really, really interested in figuring out how to make that kind of transition, not just transitioning from academia and industry, but actually getting into more of a business development or having a little bit more business savvy. So I was curious if this was something that you realized about yourself maybe when you were in graduate school or when you were doing your postdoc, that you maybe were a little bit more interested in the business angle rather than the research angle. And maybe if you were, when exactly that all kind of crystallized and you actually realized that this was something you wanted to follow up on?
Yeah, that's a great question, Brian. So I can't say that, you know, anytime, I've always considered myself a scientist first, mm-hmm. even now at Agene, while I'm in management and operations, essentially, because I'm the executive director of a company. It's like being the CEO. And so, you know, I guess I did it the easy way, I think. So when you come out of your PhD, what does your resume look like? Your mm-hmm. resume looks like you're a bench scientist, because that's what you've been doing for 6 years, right? So I did it the easy way. I went into industry as a bench scientist, mm-hmm. and I actually love bench science. I worked as a bench for 12 years. I only stopped when I had too large of a group for me to manage and still do bench work. Mm-hmm. You know, so I became a group leader toward the end of my time at Abbott, and I had a large group of people working for me. And it turned out I didn't really need to actually pipette to be happy. What makes me happy is looking at data.
Exactly.
So I was looking at data. When you have 10 people in your group, you look at a lot of data.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's what PIs really like. They like looking mm-hmm. at data. So for me, I guess what made it all possible was along the way, I kind of raised my hand and volunteered and had opportunities to do a lot of very different things. So while I was at Abbott, I managed projects. I did some international projects. I worked on many collaborations. I tried to learn the business of pharma and biotech. I did a lot of know the business. I was, you know, doing quite a bit of networking, and mm-hmm. could talk a little bit about how I got started doing that. And then in biotech, even more so, because in biotech, the company's so small, everybody has to pitch in. So, you know, there I am writing press releases. I've never written a press release before. You know, I'm pitching to investors. I never did that before, you know. Mm-hmm. So you get these opportunities as you move into different positions, and I guess I took advantage of them. I didn't like everything I had to do that had to do with business development. Mm-hmm. I don't love reading contracts. They bore me. I have to really pay attention and get help from someone who knows how to do that. Mm-hmm. It's not the whole business role is not for me, but I love working with people. I love developing talent. I love working with scientists, and you know, I'm a very sort of, I like organizational structure and strategic mm-hmm. planning, and at Agene we get to do a lot of science because we're always watching kind of what's new and exciting. So did that answer your question?
Yeah.
I think I just sort of took the opportunities as they came and didn't really say, oh, I want to, you know, my goal is to be in business development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so going back a little bit more, was there a particular moment or an interaction that you had that you realized you wanted to transition out of academia? Or was it an opportunity or maybe an internship? Or you mentioned networking. I'm assuming that you went through your fair share of informational interviews. And was it something in one of these conversations or these interactions that really sparked your interest?
Yeah, so I kind of came upon it in a lucky way. And the reason why I go out and speak with postdocs and grad students mm-hmm. is I feel like I don't want them to be lucky.
Right.
I want them
mm-hmm.
to be more concerted.
Strategic,
so
right.
What happened for me is my husband was still a student. I had a baby.
Mm-hmm.
I did not see any way that I could afford to go into an academic postdoc and still be able to work.
Right.
And I had considered going into industry. I think the reason why I considered it at that time, you know, so long ago in 91, 92, when it was just the beginnings of biotech, really,
mm-hmm.
it was just getting hot, you know, was my advisor had a lot of connections to the biotech
wow.
industry. And he was a consultant for Genetics Institute, which is one of the first biotech companies in the Boston area.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, you know, was favorably disposed toward industry-type jobs, and he knew people.
Right.
So I wasn't much of a networker then, but he knew a lot of people that were in that in that area already. And so he was the one who really introduced me to all the people who interviewed me. I didn't really do informational interviews. He basically set up, you know, called his friends and called in favors and said, hey, I have a grad student, you should interview
her. That's great.
And one of those interviews turned into a job, and then while I was there, I just worked really hard to learn about what was going on in pharma and biotech. So, you know, for me, I never had trouble with the whole, you know, I knew myself well enough to know that the sort of independent type of self-starting that was going to be needed in academia was not my strength.
Mm-hmm.
I'm much more motivated by timelines and working in a group and teamwork and, you know, having mutual goals. And so that's much more common in industry. So even though I think I would have liked to have done a postdoc first, it just financially was not did not feel feasible to me at the time.
Right.
And so when the opportunity came to go to BASF, I jumped at it.
Okay. So I'm curious, you mentioned you had been spending a lot of your time in academia, and then you had a child on the way. So I'm curious if you can elaborate on that a little bit more, because we've interacted with a lot of females that are kind of struggling with the whole work-life balance, and then a lot of them feel as if they have to put off having a child or getting married while they're in graduate school because eventually they want to get that tenure-track position. So I'm curious if you can maybe elaborate a little bit more on how that the work-life balance kind of played into your decision to transition out of academia, or if this was something you thought you can handle with everything else, or if you've, I know you've interacted with a lot of people being a part of the AWIS organization. So I'm curious if you can give us some insight into how all of that worked out for you.
Yeah, so I mean, it worked out well for me because I always was able to work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I'm working with women scientists and trying to help them work on their work-life balance issues, you know, if you take a break from science, it's very hard to get back
right.
in.
Mm-hmm.
I wish it weren't the case, but it is very hard
mm-hmm.
because science is moving fast. And I'm not the kind of person that I knew myself well enough to know that I would not be happy being at home anyway.
Right.
I think I would have been sort of, you know, not a great mom if I would have been, you know, at home. I really wanted to work and make that work.
Sure.
Now, how that worked for me is my husband was fully a 50-50 partner.
Great.
In our child rearing, in all aspects of it, you know, that is possible. And, you know, our careers, we were early in our careers together, and so we both shared everything. And I think without that, that it would have been very difficult for me.
Mm-hmm.
My advisor was very supportive and very helpful. You know, it was very shocking when I told people in my group I was, you know, nobody was married, much less, you know, on the path to motherhood and the people that were around me. So they kind of didn't get it, but they were as helpful as they could be, you know. I guess I went under an assumption, and that was, you know, I want to work, I want to be a scientist, I have to be a scientist because it's what I am,
sure.
And I'm for sure going to have children.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, to me, they cannot be mutually exclusive. They're both so part of me. There was no other way that it could have worked. So, you know, I have a very sort of different approach to work-life balance than some people.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to make it work, so you do what you have to do. But I have a lot of, you know, I've done a webinar on this topic. It's on Bite-Size Bio if people want to watch. It's kind of one of my most requested talks. I guess for me, I think that people around you begin to, you create expectations for your time. So, for example, I'm Orthodox Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
So I never, ever work on Sabbath. I've never worked on Sabbath in my whole life. No one in my family has ever worked on Sabbath.
Wow.
So 25 hours a week from sundown on Friday till an hour after sundown on Saturday, we don't work. We don't use the phone. We don't use the computer. I mean, they're not on. Okay? Never done that. Never. It's never, you know, occasionally it's been a bit of an issue, like, well, I can't call you till Saturday night, or there's been some weekend work, especially when I was in biotech.
Right.
But, you know, the people around me just learned to understand that it just was not going to happen. Similarly, when I started working at BASF, I had to pick up my children at daycare, for first my son and both my kids, and that meant I had to leave every day at 4:30.
Wow.
Pretty much without fail, you know, with very few exceptions for 15 years. And, you know, as they got older, it became less of an issue. But, you know, for probably 7-8 years, I had to leave every day, you know, at 4:30.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked 8:30 to 4:30, and I would often work more at home in the evening, but every day I would leave the building at 4:30. So people stopped scheduling for me for meetings at 4:15. You know, and people, you know, if they sent me an email, they knew that between, you know, we didn't have cell phones then, we didn't have smartphones, that between 4:30 and 8:30, I wasn't going to answer, but I might answer them later in the evening or in the morning. So I think, you know, there's an expectation that the people around you now, what is all, you know, presupposed on this is that while I'm working, I'm executing on things
right.
that are being requested of
sure.
me, and I'm doing a good job,
mm-hmm.
right? So you get that flexibility by performing and developing trust with people that, hey, you may not get it done on Saturday morning, but it's going to get done, and you are going to do a good job,
mm-hmm.
right? So for me, there just was really no choice. So, you know, people say, well, how do you just not work? How do you just do that for 25 hours a week? It just wasn't an option, you know. That's how I grew up. That's just what I wanted to do in my family, you know. And it's always worked out. So I think women especially impose on themselves a certain level of
mm-hmm.
guilt. And I also never had that guilt. I knew that if I was happy at work, then my family would be happy.
That's good.
And so, you know, you have to have and that's the balance to me. The balance
mm-hmm.
is finding happiness in both places.
Yeah, I think that's... I completely agree with that, especially when people start getting older and they realize that there are other important aspects in their life, such as their family, maybe their spouse and their children. It becomes somewhat of a challenge to start balancing what's expected of you at work and then what's expected of you when you're at home. So I can find that very difficult for a lot of people kind of transitioning from their late 20s to their early 30s when they want to start having a family, or, you know, they want to start thinking about settling down, buying a house. And my experience with academic science, it's very hard, like you said, it's very hard to take a break and then come back. So this leads nicely into one of the other questions I had. Since you have experience in both academia and in industry, I'm curious how the flexibility that you were able to experience in academia versus industry, was it a stark contrast between the two, or do you feel both of them were kind of flexible with your schedule?
Yeah, that's a good question. People ask me that a lot. I think it's a different kind of flexibility,
mm-hmm.
but you can make it, either way you can make it work.
Okay.
So, you know, if I were in academia, if I had gone on to postdoc, I think I would have chosen a lab where I knew that the lab and the head of the lab had some sense of work-life balance.
Sure. Okay.
So I wouldn't go to a lab where I know that the PI, you know, perhaps is single and working 24/7, because then he or she might not be understanding, you know, of my work-life
right.
need for work-life balance. So I think we make choices that can make it easier and harder. Now, the
mm-hmm.
academic, you know, the pressures are to you know, you can work, you can do science around the clock. You can keep to, you know, I there were some 18-hour days where I just wanted to see those colonies grow
mm-hmm.
when I wasn't going to go home until I saw them, you know. So you can do that. I think that the trick for people who want to have a family and want to have not just a family, I mean, when I talk about work-life balance, maybe you want to run a marathon.
Sure.
Maybe you have a parent, an adult parent that you need to help care for.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have anything to do with children or spouses. It has to do with relationships,
mm-hmm.
usually, right? So anybody wants to have that balance. Now, if you don't care about that, you can go to a lab where the demands on you are to be there 20 hours a day. That's okay. You may, but if you know that that's not for you, then you have to make those choices very consciously.
Mm-hmm.
In industry, similarly, the flexibility there is that the days that you have to be at work are a little bit more prescribed, and you're sort of expected to be at work 9 to 5,
mm-hmm.
but it's not weird when you go home at 5. So in an academic lab, you know, if you're not there till 6 or 7, it might be perceived, this isn't true and isn't the case, but it might be perceived that you're not working hard
sure,
enough.
Sure.
In industry, people may work again later in the evening, but the work day is more prescribed and
mm-hmm.
more understood. All bets are a little bit off in a very fast-paced biotech, because there it's really, really fun, but it can be really
mm-hmm.
demanding as far as hours. But, you know, I think you just strike a balance. You learn to work more efficiently. You learn to not waste your time.
Mm-hmm.
You learn what's important, like, you know, at one point, this is just a really lame example, but I don't know, about 10 years ago, I stopped folding laundry. I just stopped. It was just taking so much time, and it just got messed up again. So we would just do the laundry and leave it in the baskets. And actually, I didn't even separate the laundry. I would take my son's laundry, put it
mm-hmm.
in the machine, put it in the dryer, put it in the basket, put it in his room. and it was up to him if he wanted to disentangle it, you know, like, and my daughter the same thing, and my husband and I, you know, the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It just saved me, like, you know, a couple hours a week, but just why bother? Nobody in my family ever makes their bed, because you're just going to unmake it again. So that wasn't an argument we were willing to get into. It just uh-huh. didn't seem worth it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So there were some things we just, like, let go of and said, these things are not important, and it's okay if we have hot dogs three nights in a row. We will survive, you know. And so by letting some of those things slide, some of that, you know, tension, you know, controlling tension, detritus, mm-hmm. it just freed up time for the other things that were more important for us.
I really like those pieces of advice. I think I might try to implement those here. I feel the same way. Most of my clothes, after they're done in the dryer, I usually just kind of lay them out on something, so all the wrinkles eventually make them make their own way out. Folding, I completely agree, just takes up so much time. And, you know, again, when you're really busy and you have children and you have other priorities, you have other, you know, I know you're incredibly busy. This is something else I wanted to ask you about too. You do quite a lot of outreach and a lot of speaking as well. So I'm curious, how are you able to fit all of that in your regular schedule?
Yeah, so I have to say that was very difficult until I started working at Agene.
Mm-hmm.
One of the great things about Agene is that one of the jobs of an executive director is to talk to people.
Sure.
It's like part of my... So can you still hear me?
Yes, sorry about that.
Sorry, I think my phone, I'm going to switch phones. One second here. Sorry about that. Okay. So one of the great things about being an executive director is it is actually in your role definition to be out and about.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in my case, most speaking is mostly to postdocs and grad students, which is the people who I'm out supposed to be out there talking to.
Sure.
So Agene is extremely generous with my time, and when I can get out and talk to groups of scientists, I'm really excited. I'm starting to get invited to go to other cities and,
mm-hmm.
you know, some of these... Some universities and postdoc offices have budget for speakers
right.
to come and present. So I've been invited. Some of my, you know, we're a nonprofit, so it's great. They can support my travel some of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Agene also helps support my travel and my time. So the last couple years has been really fun, and I've started to have more time to do speaking. It was quite challenging and sometimes, you know, did cause tension in my family when I was out one or two nights a week. You know, doing a presentation or
mm-hmm.
doing a work, you know, doing work. But that has eased up in the last couple of years.
Right.
You know, I think when it comes to, you have to do things that are important to you and make you happy, but you also have to have, you know, both a to-do list and a to-don't list.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I would get invited to be on certain boards or to attend certain meetings, and sometimes I would just have to say, I just can't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have too much on my plate right now. So I'm pretty careful to only accept things that I feel like I can do well.
Sure.
You know, so I'm on the board of a couple different organizations now, and that time came from the fact that my kids aren't home anymore. So I had an enormous amount of time freed up. It's not like to me, so that when, you know, Science Club for Girls called and said, are you ready to be on our board? We've been waiting for you. And I said, oh, I've been waiting for you. I'm so excited to have the time, you know, to do that now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how it's been. I think, though, it is very important to make sure that you don't get so focused on your bench science that
mm-hmm.
you don't do... So all these other things that I did all contributed to my network, to my career, to my sort of soft skill building. And had I not done a little bit all along the way, I wouldn't be where I am now.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's incredibly important. And, you know, again, just to list some of the places that you've presented at just this past year, you mentioned you've presented at AAAS, NIH... University of Michigan, University of Minnesota, Yale, MIT, Harvard, Tufts. So, I mean, I assume you are incredibly busy, but just like you mentioned, this is really important, giving these presentations, because, again, it's working on your networking opportunity. It's working on your presentation skills, your communication skills. And, you know, even to push this a little bit further, you have quite a lot of webinars here that I've found as well. One of the most popular ones that a lot of my colleagues really enjoy, you have one at the NIH Career, it's an NIH Career Webinar, the Academia to Industry Transition. I know I've shown this to several people, and it's a great great resource for anybody that hasn't seen it. I highly recommend it. I'm going to put all these links up on the website. You just have a wealth of information here. So one of the other questions I want to ask you about, as you're going through all these presentations at the different universities, different institutes, different organizations, what's one of the most common questions that some of these postdocs or graduate students are asking you?
So, what a great question. So first, thanks, Brian. I mean, I do these things because I want to get the word out. People mm-hmm. are always, like, calling me and asking me if they can use one of my webinars, like, at a postdoc meeting. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's the whole point.
Yeah.
I'm so delighted that people are finding them useful and sometimes linking in with me and emailing me and asking
Definitely.
Me further questions.
Mm-hmm.
Every time people ask me questions or give me feedback on my talks, you know, I make them better. So I really appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting. Over the sort of 10 years that I've been speaking, my most requested topic has shifted.
Really?
So, yeah. So early on, I no matter where I went, I have like a list of different seminars that I give. I think I've sent it to you.
Mm-hmm.
And the work-life balance, everybody wanted me to do work-life
mm-hmm.
balance. I was like dying from giving that talk. I gave it like 50 times one year, I think. Maybe not 50, but it felt like it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to me, it's not really skill building. It's not that it's not important, but, it's actually not my favorite talk. It's funny. It's entertaining. It's always fun to do with
mm-hmm.
people. But, and so then it shifted a little, and I started being asked to speak much more often on networking.
Okay.
And that is still a very popular talk. I spent a couple years there where almost all of my talks were around mentoring. And now, by far, probably, I don't know, 8-1, my most popular talk is the talk the academia takes to transition. So,
I wonder
you know,
what that
and
says.
That talk is I get a lot of feedback, and it isn't really just, so that talk is actually, organized as top 10 questions that people ask me about transitioning
really?
To industry, and so, you know, the very, if you, I don't want to give away the punchline, but those really are the top 10 questions that people
okay.
ask me.
Okay.
And, you know, they have to do with the differences between academia and industry
mm-hmm.
and the differences between pharma and biotech and how did I do it? You know, so what are the ways that I recommend now that people look for work when they want to make that transition?
Mm-hmm.
And I spend a lot of time talking about what you can do while you're in academia to develop the skills and prepare yourself so you're a more attractive candidate for
right.
industry. And that seems to be the most popular part of that talk.
Okay. So something else I wanted to go back to, I'm actually curious about, I'm actually very curious about this because several of the organizations that I kind of work with, there are a lot of individuals that, you know, you mentioned it was luck. Some of it was luck that you had a mentor, a PI that had a lot of industry contacts and kind of helped you along the way with the networking and informational interviews and the introductions. So now imagine you were in a different situation where your PI didn't have all those connections and this person, he or she, was more involved in kind of the academic expectations that you would pursue a tenure track position. Now, how would you go about explaining to your PI, or what would be a good way that you've seen over the past few years, maybe if you have some examples that other postdocs or graduate students have brought up to their PI, to kind of open up this dialogue and kind of start the conversation of, you know, I'd like to explore some other opportunities. What could you suggest?
Yeah. It's a tough one. So, you know, there's kind of a lot of different answers to this question depending on what stage you are,
mm-hmm.
you find yourself. So if you are a graduate student and your university has a biotech club or a consulting club,
okay.
You know, I think it's really important that you get involved in those types of activities quickly and openly.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're very early in your graduate career, I have a talk on how to choose a lab.
Yes.
And, you know, even if you're not sure if you're going to industry, I think it's a good idea to choose a PI that at least accepts that path.
Sure.
And I have a lot of advice on how to figure that out, you know, before you choose the lab. So if you're early on and you're rotating and you're choosing labs, don't go somewhere where the advisor is known to be sort of anti-industry. Even if you're going to choose an academic path, you don't give yourself the option, right?
Mm-hmm.
And your advisors, and I'll talk about postdocing in a second, but when you're a graduate student, you don't have a lot of references.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, your advisor is like your one most important reference.
Yes.
And if he or she does not support writing the recommendation for you for an industry position, you can be in real trouble. you know, as far as getting a job, because you really need that recommendation. So there's some things you can do. You can work on a collaboration and get the other PI to, you know, be a reference for you. That's one, you know, good way to do it. Try and volunteer on committees or other places in your department and get to know other PIs, other senior people that can write references for you. So those are really important relationships to build. It's all about who you're meeting, the relationships you're building, right? That's what's going to help you.
Right.
Now, if you're late in the game and you're stuck and your advisor is not going to be supportive, then networking becomes even more important.
Right.
Because the job opportunities are only going to come to you if someone knows you and respects you and trusts that even though your advisor is not so honky-dory on writing you a recommendation for academia, in fact, I know many people, you may be sneaking around behind his or her back, right, looking for a job, then the people that you're applying to, you know, the more that they know you, if they've met you in some other capacity, the more likely you are to have an opportunity there. You know, so many jobs in industrial science, government science, never get advertised.
Right.
They just, you know, it's people know, it's the people that you know that are starting a company that are looking for someone who can do X, and you just happen to be able to do X, you know. So at every stage, it's important to know people, but the later you are and the less helpful your advisor is going to be. Now, if I had it to do again, I would in a very concerted fashion, choose a lab where the advisor is on the board of a company, has started his or her own company, you know, has had postdocs go on into industry, and he has helped them get those jobs, or you know that she has, you know, helped her students and written those letters. And these are questions you can ask the people and the alumni from the lab that you're thinking of going to. So I've heard people say that when they choose a postdoc, they think the most important thing is to choose, you know, a Nobel Prize winner, someone very famous, or an HHMI scholar. It turns out that your best sort of measure for success, if you are, you know, if you are one of the 60% of people that are going to go into a non-academic career, is the open-mindedness of the advisor toward that career path.
Right.
Way more important. So even if he or she is young, doesn't have the Nobel Prize, does not have 100 Cell papers, but, you know, he interacts with people in industry, or she sits on the board of some startup, that's going to be much more helpful to you. I know it seems counterintuitive, but it is actually the case.
Yeah, you mentioned the opportunity people have. The opportunity that people have to transition to industry, and sometimes it's through the biotech route, or sometimes it's sometimes it's through a small company. Sorry about that. And I'm curious if you think the kind of following that route after an academic position, maybe working for a small biotech, a company that's relatively small, maybe 20 employees or less. How do you think that affects the likelihood that you will move on into a larger company and maybe gain some of the skills or experience that you need that would be highly sought after, I guess, in a larger, you know, I again go back to your experience because you mentioned you transitioned from academia into biotech, a relatively small company. You got a lot of experience and you're probably multitasking quite a lot of, probably just multitasking in general. And then you were able to transition to a larger pharma like Abbott. So I'm, you know, curious if you can kind of put all that into perspective about the different lifestyle that you had in each situation, how some of the experiences that you had maybe in smaller biotech and academia then helped you later on to get your position at Abbott and then later on for Adgene.
Yeah, so I actually transitioned directly to a pharmaceutical company. So BASF was a fairly large company.
Okay.
We were in a sort of smaller part of it.
Okay.
So there were about, you know, 80 people at our company at the time, although we grew to be about 700.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But it was part of a big company, so it had a very big company feel. It had a kind of biotech creativity feel, but it had a big company sort of bureaucracy feel.
Okay.
And, you know, Abbott even more so. But I don't really think, I think you can move between biotech and large company jobs in tech and in life sciences.
Okay.
I think it's just the skills that you're working on along the way. So one nice thing about biotechs is they tend to be a little more forgiving about very specific skill sets. So a pharmaceutical company might need you to know exactly a specific assay or have very defined skills to make that transition.
Right.
Whereas a biotech might say, well, we just need somebody who has a lot of energy and who's really smart. Because you're gonna every day you're gonna be learning new things, and what they really want is somebody who's flexible and can learn new things.
Okay.
You know, and is smart. So the kind of you know, that might give you an opportunity to get into industry, and then while you're there, it's what you make of it.
Mm-hmm.
So what skills are you building? Are you building your network? Are you meeting people in other companies and learning about what they do? There's so many different opportunities. You can't even imagine it. There's no way I could even teach it that. It's just so vast.
Mm-hmm.
You can only learn it along the way, a little at a time. So, you know, while I was in the biotech, which was sort of a little later in my career, I was always in touch with people in industry and, you know, maintaining those in pharma,
mm-hmm.
maintaining those relationships, because, you know, I didn't know if I would be interested in. There might be jobs in pharma that would be really interesting. It wasn't like that was a one-way street when I went to work at a biotech. So I think it's once you're in the industry, you have a really great opportunity to learn more about it, to go
mm-hmm.
to networking events. Every state has a trade association.
Right.
You know, to go to trade association events, to make sure that you're meeting other people and, you know, taking them to coffee, learn about what they're doing. You can't build your network when you need it. You have to build it over a long time so that when you need it, it's there,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when I went to when I was looking for work after my biotech, you know, downsized, I had, you know, dozens of people that I could call and talk to and connect with to really get to almost any company in
right.
the Boston area. And it was all those opportunities that were leading to interviews and, you know, opportunities and more information and, you know, and so that was a network that was existing. It wasn't like I had to go out and create it. I had dozens of people who were already willing to talk to me and help
mm-hmm.
me.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's extremely helpful to have a network that you can kind of leverage at some time when you're actually starting to look for positions. And again, as you mentioned, a lot of the positions that are available, some of them aren't even posted. So again, it's very important to have people that are somewhat connected and in the know ahead of time. And this is something I see with a lot of postdocs that I interact with. They don't really, it's hard for me to say they don't see the value, but that's my perception. They don't see the value in networking, or a lot of them actually don't know how to do it. Just simply going to some of these conferences or these trade association meetings and just interacting
right.
with individuals outside of their lab, outside of the academic bubble. I think a lot of them don't understand the value that comes with that. And again, it becomes unfortunate when they're faced with a tough reality of, you know, what do I do after my postdoc if I can't get an academic position? So now, as you mentioned, your network becomes more out of necessity than out of slowly growing and interacting with individuals over a period of time. So, I want to go back to your experience as a graduate student. Now, the lab that you were in, were there other individuals that chose to stay in academia?
Yeah, there were. So the postdoc that was sort of the main person that trained me
mm-hmm.
went on to an academic career.
Okay.
We had a pretty small lab, so there weren't, you know, a lot. One postdoc ended up in industry.
Okay.
One postdoc is doing, you know, very well at the Fox Chase Cancer Center, and so she has an mm-hmm. academic posting. One became a lawyer.
Oh, wow.
So one, actually, a senior graduate student in the lab got her PhD and then went to law school, and that's another path
wow.
that many PhD scientists take,
mm-hmm.
and is a very successful IP lawyer here in the Boston area. So they really had a very diverse set of outcomes, and, you know, that was partially because my advisor was very accepting of
right.
and supportive of any path that we took and made it, you know, did everything he could to help us.
Right.
So, you know, I think we all had training to go either way,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we all, I think we, you know, many of us did quite well, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
I mean, it sounds like it, all the different paths and avenues that everybody kind of followed. I mean, the reason that I was asking is, did you find it useful in your lab, or maybe your lab and maybe a few other labs, people, graduate students, postdocs that you were interacting with regularly, did you find it useful to maybe set up a club or an organization where you can talk about these things and kind of utilize each other and each other's networks to really explore some of these other options? Because again, I wasn't expecting you to say that people went to academic institutes, went to nonprofits, people went into industry, people went into law. I mean, that's a really great a great background and experience from just one lab, and I'm curious if you know you guys were able to build on that during your time as a graduate student.
So you know, it's interesting. You know, at the time, you know, I mean, this is a long time ago. Right? So science looked a little different than it does now. I mean, I always advocate, you know, support groups and postdoc, you know, education and mentoring group mm-hmm. programs, because I think there's no reason to go it alone.
Right.
We should be helping each other. So one thing that drives me crazy is I go speak in a department, and these are all people that are in the same department, which means they are like your first network, mm-hmm. right? You're like level one network. And any of those people that you're in the room with could leave where they are and go to an interesting job that mm-hmm. maybe you want to know about in a year,
exactly.
right?
Exactly.
And if you're in touch and friendly with them and in contact enough to know where these people around you end up and what their path is, you can learn so much from mm-hmm. it, right? So I come in to speak, and the people come into the room, and they don't talk to each other. I'm even giving a talk on networking. Let's say I'm giving my networking workshop, uh-huh. and they come in the room, and they will all sit like one or two seats away
yep.
from the next person.
Yep.
You know, like that's just like networking 101. Just sit down next to someone and introduce yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the easiest way to meet someone,
right.
you know. And so to me, it's just very funny for me to see how, you know, there's some very simple things that you can do, even not even reaching out, but just meeting people around you at a time when you are at a natural time to meet someone, which is at a seminar or a talk that you're both interested in,
right.
you know. So I really, really advocate starting your network where it's easy, which is your department, your
mm-hmm.
school, you know, locally. And hopefully that will grow into a network that's more national, you know, and more diverse as
right.
people do different things. Because, you know that 60% of those people are not going to take a traditional academic
mm-hmm.
path. That's
yeah.
the numbers,
right.
you know. So all those people, you know, you're a second year, and that sixth-year grad student, you know, he or she's going to do something interesting,
right.
you know. And it'd be great if you knew where they ended up because you were friendly with them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you may want to post a link to my YouTube. There's ASCB and iBio helped me create a webinar on that topic.
Okay.
And you can find it on YouTube by looking for my name
okay.
on YouTube. Or go
yes.
to the ASCB, the American Society for Cell Biology, YouTube page.
Okay.
And, you know, that is where I really give sort of very concrete tips for, you know, the I don't know how to start networking scientist, you know. And really some steps that you can take to what that means to create. And I don't even like the word networking, because really what you're doing is just making relationships.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the first things I tell people is you don't have to make relationships with people you don't like. That's like a big misperception of networking, that
mm-hmm.
you're supposed to exchange your card and stay in touch with people that you don't care for. Really, just start out with the people you like.
Right.
You know, you have something in common with, and you have something to talk to them about, you know, and then, you know, see what you can do for them. Do them a favor. All those favors will come back to you a hundredfold.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know, and that's certainly how it's worked for me. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of very easy, small things that people can do and make it happen. So I have a rule I've had for almost 20 years. I have lunch with another human being, like I don't sit in my office and eat my sandwich,
mm-hmm.
For 20 years, at least twice a week.
Wow.
It's on my calendar. Either I go out of the building, either I meet with a friend in the building,
mm-hmm.
you know, in my lab, in a different lab, in a different department, whatever it is. But because the temptation when you have, you know, two small children and
sure.
you're working very hard is to want to sit in your office and eat your sandwich by yourself and, you know, look at the computer and, you know, just veg out.
Right.
That is a temptation, but it's so much more valuable to spend 45 minutes in the cafeteria talking to people,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. Again, especially when your job requires you to be behind a computer most of the day or doing kind of isolated work, I think it is really important to step outside of that bubble and interact with individuals. I mean, again, you make a great point. They could be individuals within your building and people within your department, but just somebody else outside of your lab or outside of the space that you're working in every single day. Because again, it may not be that person that is doing exactly what you want to do, but it's you can learn from their experience. Maybe you could share something in common, or maybe they have somebody they can put you in touch with.
Right.
And I believe that is extremely important. I completely agree with you. This strangely enough leads into one of the other important questions I wanted to ask you as well about your current position. And besides taking the opportunity to interact with individuals on a weekly basis, and then also doing a significant amount of outreach. I'm curious what a typical day or a typical week looks like for you in your current position.
Oh, wow. So,
if there is a typical day.
I do a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. That is one fun thing about being in a sort of operations type position.
Sure.
So what are the some things I do during the week?
Mm-hmm.
So I do get out and speak pretty much every week somewhere. And so that's been fun. I spend a lot of time reading papers, actually, because I'm looking for, I have to be very, the whole company, all the scientists in our company do this, mostly because we like it. You know, we need to be very conversant with what new plasmid technologies
right.
are coming out and what's new and hot, because those are the things that we need to pursue for our repository, because we know that those are the things people are going to ask for.
Mm-hmm.
So we're constantly reaching out to potential partners, potential depositors, you know, reading what's hot, tracking what's going on in science. We're very aligned with the open science and open publishing community because we're all about open data and,
yes.
and sharing of materials. So Agene actually uses a material transfer agreement, so our materials
mm-hmm.
are transferred under a legal agreement, but it's a very simple and rapid process.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It takes 3 seconds to complete. So, you know, we are always aligned with that community. So I will often have be involved in social media or talking with people at journals.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, again, a lot of what I do is call people, ask them, how can Agene work with you and, you know, help shepherd those projects and those collaborations along. Right now we're exploring, and so that's one big part. That's a big fun part of my job is the science and what's going on
mm-hmm.
in the science and in the scientific community. I do a lot of internal stuff. So Agene, you know, I have operations work. So how is the facility? What is our budget like?
Mm-hmm.
How are we doing against our budget? Are we spending appropriately? You know, are we? We're a nonprofit, so we don't have investors that make money. All of our money that we make goes back into the repository. So, you know, can we afford to hire another person? The lab
mm-hmm.
is short-staffed. You know, can we do that, making decisions like that?
Mm-hmm.
I am responsible as the executive director for keeping our board. We have a board of directors informed and involved in our processes. We have 4 meetings a year with the board. So I prepare board materials. I communicate with We have both a scientific advisory board and a board of directors, and
mm-hmm.
I recruit people for those boards, and there's a whole facet to my job where that's one of my responsibilities. I do a lot of personnel management, so I mediate issues. I, you know, help decide who should be promoted, you know, what's appropriate, what the timing is of personnel changes.
Mm-hmm.
I pretty much have personnel issues on a weekly basis, and not very serious ones. Agene is a very,
mm-hmm.
very great culture, great place to work. So it's usually, you know, figuring out how to reward people for their service or to really give them growth opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that's a fun. I like to do career development, so I also do that in my own home turf.
Gotcha.
We have a seminar series that we do at the company.
Mm-hmm.
We have monthly meetings, and we have book club and. You know, we have all kinds of morale, kind of cultural things. We do cook-offs.
Wow.
It's kind of our funnest, most fun activities. So, you know, day-to-day, I can be doing, you know, a dozen different things a day that involve reading and writing and talking with people. It's very varied. I don't do any bench work, and I'm not doing any actual data, but I am reading a lot of science and kind of making sure I understand, you know, the new technologies and what's being invented.
Mm-hmm.
So,
extremely busy. So, for those of you that are not familiar with Agene, I'm extremely familiar with the services because we use a lot of their plasmids pretty often. Could you describe just a little bit of the background of what Agene is?
Yeah, sure. So Agene was founded almost 10 years ago. We have a big, it's our 10th anniversary next year, so we're going to
mm-hmm.
have a lot of fun stuff going on. It was started by a woman named Melina Fan and her husband and her brother, and she is a biologist. Her husband is a software engineer and her brother is an MBA.
Okay.
And she basically, as a graduate student, had the experience where she tried to get, you know, genes for 10 different plasmids for 10 different genes
mm-hmm.
from different labs around the country to kind of follow up on a result she had in a project. And, you know, not only was that very difficult, but a lot of what she got was incorrect.
Yep, yep.
And she just said, this is terrible. You know, this is, there's got to be a better way.
Yes.
And so this was really her brainchild, and she's very bright, and the three of them are very tenacious and have a lot of common sense, and they just started slow and, you know, went around and knocking on doors of PIs saying, hey, if we did this, would you, you know, you famous scientists, you know, they got a very some heavy hitters on first.
Right.
Would you contribute to our repository? We wouldn't pay you anything, but we would take care of distributing your materials, you know, around the world, and
sure.
we would create a website to publicize it, and, you know, what do you think about that?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they spent a lot of time gathering information, what that had to look like to work, and then they launched it, and the company broke even in 2007. So it was founded in 2004, and in a pretty short time, the distribution started supporting the work of the repository.
Yeah.
And now we have, we ship about, I don't know, we're shipping about 2,000 things a week.
Wow.
yeah, not, I mean, 2,000 plasmids, so fewer orders than that, but about 2,000 plasmids per week. And we have just a little over 30 employees. It's a big effort. We have, you know, the lab team. We have a scientist team that does quality control and basically answers people's questions.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of what the PhD scientists do is help people get their experiments to work, troubleshoot issues with the plasmid. We're always curating the library,
yes.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've actually started doing a lot of educational materials and resources on the website. You know, so we have one of the only resources, for example, where you can see, get help picking a plasmid backbone.
Yep.
You know, with a sort of unbiased view. Like, what do I need to know to pick the backbone? And so we have a sort of unbiased, we're not commercial, so, you know, we can kind of tell you these are the factors, these are some things you might want to think about as you're designing your backbone, you know.
Right.
So we're creating a lot of those resources. And so the company is, you know, doing well, and we have great support from our depositors. So it's those people that really make it possible. We've got 1,700 scientists, PIs, who have deposited their materials to the repository.
Mm-hmm.
We are extremely grateful to them. They don't receive anything in return except, excuse me, if they distribute, they get frequent distributor points. So if their materials distribute a lot, then they get free plasmids for their lab.
Yeah, I saw some of the really hot plasmids. They get on fire.
Right, so some labs never pay for plasmids, let me tell you, because if they have a little blue flame, that's our color, and we're scientists, you know, the blue flame is the hottest.
Right.
That means it's been distributed over 100 times, which, you know, if you think about it, if you had to go into tell your tech to send something out 100 times to 80 different countries, right, it's that's a lot of time, and you know, we can do that much more efficiently for you. So what's also great, what's very rewarding for us, is the scientists that thank us all the time. We have an extremely supportive constituency out there, and especially people in far-flung, you know, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Brazil, you know, Australia, which is very hard to ship to Australia and New Zealand. We know how to do that, you know. These are people that aren't in the thick of, you know, they maybe have very small scientific communities locally, but this really allows them to access materials from all over the world. And so we get a lot of satisfaction from helping those scientists.
Right. Yeah, I've used AdGene for several years now, and I have to say the customer support, the MTA, which you mentioned, sometimes can be very frustrating to read through when you're dealing with other universities or institutes, very straightforward with AdGene. And the speed at which we get our plasmids is kind of lightning speed. I mean, you can order, and it really comes very quickly. So I really, really like AdGene service quite a lot. And I think it was born out of a really great and a very believable story. Again, when you try to interact with other labs, especially outside of the United States, sometimes because there's so many rules and regulations now, to get one plasmid, sign all the MTA agreements, go back and forth between the university, can be sometimes up to 2 months before you actually receive that 2 microliter vial that you need to start your experiments. And it's just, it's crazy to think about. So the first place I always look is on AdGene to find
I think people shouldn't clone until they check, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you can't find something, you should call us, because mm-hmm. our scientists can often find things that are buried in there.
Yes.
We're actually working on our search engine right now to make it better.
Mm-hmm.
But people should definitely call us if they're having trouble finding something that they need. Because we want, what we do. We're there all day helping people find what they want.
Right.
I guess I would say, in a more general level, if you are a grad student or a postdoc and you have an idea about something that, is not working in science mm-hmm. and you think you can do better, a startup is pretty exciting and fun.
Mm-hmm.
And, in this case, it was a nonprofit startup, so the goals were a little different. But I think it says that anybody with a good idea and the energy and the initiative can really create something really big. So.
Right.
We started out with 3 people. We have 30 people.
Mm-hmm.
And we've grown this enormous community. It's really something to be proud of, and it's just anyone can do it. I mean, it can be done. So.
Yeah, I think that's part of the excitement sometimes about being in a large university, just recognizing some of the deficiencies in the system, and then acknowledging that you have the opportunity to kind of start and make this process better, more efficient. And that's, again, where the startup space is. It can be very exciting. You're hitting on another topic that I wanted to ask you about. I mean, a lot of this, I assume, your experience and kind of reflecting back on the skills that you picked up as a graduate student, what would you say was the most valuable skill that you picked up along the way that you've utilized, up to the point where we are right now, where we're having this conversation?
Wow, as a graduate student. So, I really had a great experience learning to be a scientist.
Mm.
I mean, I think that's what you're doing in graduate school. And my advisor, really, really taught me how to design an experiment, be critical of data, read a paper.
Mm-hmm.
He gave us opportunities to really be involved in all aspects of running the lab, grant writing, paper writing, speaking, so he was a really great mentor in sort of empowering us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's that whole package. It's not any one thing that mm-hmm. that was the most valuable. If it's anything, it was a small lab, and he was a very new PI. So I guess I would say I had to have a lot of initiative.
Right.
He was around. It wasn't like he was not available because, again, it was just a few of us, and he was very present and available. So I think it wasn't so much initiative to find him, but initiative to kind of get what I needed. Sometimes mm-hmm. it meant going outside the lab. Sometimes it meant, he wouldn't have the skill that I needed to do an experiment, and I would have to go find that, somewhere else.
Right.
So I think it was probably that initiative to solve a problem and without kind of throwing up my hands and saying, well, I can't get this here,
mm-hmm.
but then it forced me to kind of go out of my comfort zone and go find another person, be comfortable asking questions, and go find it somewhere else.
Yeah.
And so that's probably the kind of characteristic that was most helpful, because that's always important.
Okay. Yeah, that makes complete sense. I've got 2 other questions for you, and these are a little bit more outside of the box, I guess, kind of putting on a different hat. And it requires you to think more as an academic PI. So I'm going to test you on your memory of being a good advisor. So if you, taking into consideration everything that you've learned along the way, and where you are now, if you were to go back and become an academic advisor at an institution in some kind of academic realm, how would you prepare your students or your trainees for the real world as you see it now?
Oh, wow. I mean, that's kind of what I'm out there doing all the time. So
mm-hmm.
academic or no, the academic advisors that I admire the most now
mm-hmm.
are the ones that say, I know how to become an academic advisor because I did that, But what I don't know is if you don't want to do that, I don't know how to do that because I didn't do it. So I'm going to help you find the resources, and I'm going to support your lunch and learn,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to support your time and not stand in your way and expect you to be at the bench all day. I'm going to support you in doing other things for your career.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's really the most important thing. You want to choose a lab where the advisor understands that it's not just about the bench work.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
Does that answer your question?
I think that's, again, I completely agree with that, especially now when a lot of the labs are starting to split up into PIs that are maybe more of the old school mentality where they don't really acknowledge some of the challenges that some of the new trainees are starting to face when they're looking for a position in academia and even outside of academia. It's a very tough market. And those that go above and beyond what's just required to keep their lab running, and that includes training and actual mentorship and preparing their students and taking an active interest in their development and their progress as a trainee and eventually a professional. I definitely agree with you, and this was one of the reasons I'm glad that you and I were able to interact, because we see a lot of this at the same level, and I think understand how important it is, and that's why you're a great resource for outreach, and you're doing a fantastic job. And I think the more people that understand this, the more, especially the more PIs that understand this, this is only how it's going to change and how people become more prepared and ready for that next step. So, the last question I have for you, again, this is more of a global question, again, taking into consideration some of your experience and reflecting back a little bit. In relatively simple terms, can you define the value of having a PhD? And I ask this because a lot of people kind of go back and forth that I've seen on message boards or just topics of debate where people will say, it's not worth it to go get your PhD anymore because there's this glut of PhDs. It's better to get your bachelor's and get some industry experience or go into a master's of biotechnology training program where you have that hands-on experience instead of going and getting that PhD. So I'm curious to hear your take on this.
Oh, yeah. So I would never trade in having gotten a PhD.
Okay.
It is not for everyone, though. So I think the key is to figure out if you do not like doing bench work and you really hate it, I wouldn't spend 6 years at a life science PhD because, that's a long time to get poorly paid to do something as a stepping stone to get into business.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, completely.
Right. But the fact is, I loved all parts of my PhD,
Mm-hmm.
and I love doing bench work, and I love doing science. So for me, it is a way of thinking and seeing the world that I wanted to be a part of. And I think you only get it when you spend those 6 years in the academic setting. I picked a good academic setting. I had one that was open to other ways of thinking, again, somewhat in a lucky fashion, but for me, it was a really good match. So I think you can be exploring industry while you're getting your academic PhD. But there is no doubt that having a PhD still does open different
Right.
doors for you. It's not that it opens the only doors, it's just different. So I love I would I you know my my I loved graduate school. We complain about it. We have a sort of a whiny culture in science.
Sure.
Oh, I'm at the lab for so many hours. Oh, it's so hard. Oh, my advisor's so awful. I can't believe I'm in the lab at 2 in the morning. But really, why are you in the lab at 2 in the morning? Because you can't wait to see what's going to
Right,
happen.
exactly. It's the
You know,
excitement.
you want that result so bad that you're going to be at the lab at 2 in the morning. And when you find out, maybe it worked, maybe it didn't, and maybe it's back to the drawing board. But wow, we do it really because it's part of our nature. Now, I think you really do have to do a little self-exploration if that's, what you want. So I always tell young people, you have to spend a summer at the bench and make sure you like this thing, you know. And so, but it definitely opens different doors. I do not think we have seen the end of the PhD. Now, one thing I would say as a cautionary tale, though, you do not want to be a PhD and a postdoc forever.
Right.
So you should be done in absolutely 6 years, hopefully 5 years with your graduate career. I mean, you should be aiming to get out, not aiming to stay. You know
Right,
what I mean?
exactly.
And in a postdoc, 3 to 4 years tops. You should never stay anywhere more than 3 to 4 years if you can at all prevent it.
Right, yes.
And I have other advice about that, but it's not something that's a forever thing, but it's just a really important stage that you should be involved in.
Right. Yeah, I completely agree. It should be a limited time that you're spending each of these positions because, again, they're somewhat contract positions and they are essentially training positions. So you don't want to be spending all of your time in a training position because at that point you're not really training for anything anymore. That becomes your life position.
Right, you're just a slave, really.
So.
I mean, it's, you know, so again, this is one of those things where you vote with your feet. Don't go to labs where the PIs are not good mentors and don't get their people out. You know, you shouldn't work for those people. You should go to the people that are great at training and turning around their postdocs and PhDs and, you know, moving them on to, you know, be their own bosses and their own, have their own opportunities. A lot, 9 years is a, so I say six and, you know, five and four, six and three is a long time to be training.
Right.
And it would be great if we could sort of modify that system a little, I think. But regardless, no longer than that.
Yeah. Well, that's very good advice to end on, Joanne. I really appreciate you having this conversation with me and giving back some of your insight and some of your expertise. And again, for any of the listeners, I think one of the best ways to follow Joanne and see everything that she's done is go straight to Google and type in her name. There's quite a lot of outreach that she's done, a lot of great videos, a lot of great webinars. The other two websites I would highly recommend, if Joanne doesn't mind, is LinkedIn. She has a great up-to-date profile on there, and a lot of the information that she has and the outreach that she's done is also located there. And she's also located on Twitter, and you can find her at JKAMENS on the Twitter website. So, Joanne, I, again, really appreciate you coming on and sharing some advice and expertise with us. And I would also encourage all the listeners to go check out AdGene, if not just for the pure excitement to see which plasmids are really hot, but also for some of their educational tools, as Joanne mentioned. So if there is anything else, you know, feel free to keep in touch. And were there any parting words, Joanne?
I just wanted to say thank you. Hopefully we'll meet in person sometime.
Yes, I look forward to it. Enjoy the rest of your day. And again, I really appreciate you coming on.
Great, thanks.
Thanks, Joanne. Take care.